Welcome to the Capital Connection, a weekly program questioning New York State leaders on a variety of issues. Your host is Dr. Alan Chartok, political scientist and professor emeritus at the University at Albany. Distribution for the Capital Connection is made possible with the help of New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.
It's the Capital Connection. Hi, I'm Alan Chartok. Joining us this week is New York State Assemblyman Richard Gottfried, a Democrat who represents New York's 75th Assembly District covering Chelsea, Hell's Kitchen, Murray Hill, Midtown, and part of the Lincoln Center area in Manhattan. He's chair of the Assembly Health Committee since 1987. He's a leading state health policymaker, not only in New York, but also nationally. Welcome, Assemblyman Dick Gottfried. Always great to see a guy I sort of grew up around.
Well, we all grew up together. Good to be with you again.
Dick, let's talk a little bit about single-payer health coverage, something you've always been very interested in. I certainly agree with that. But most people think, you know, that ain't going to happen, is it?
Well, I think our experience with the Affordable Care Act is teaching us that, you know, however you dress up the insurance-based health coverage system, it's still going to be what it is, with excessive premiums and deductibles and copayments and narrowly limited provider networks and hassling over what they'll cover and what they won't cover, and all of it being funded unfairly with no relation to ability to pay. And about 30 cents of every healthcare dollar goes to administrative costs and profit. And, you know, no industrial country on earth does it that way, and we don't have to either. And I think the Affordable Care Act is demonstrating to people that while it's done a lot of very good, important things, you know, as long as we have a system based in insurance companies, there are just going to be profound problems that none of us should have to deal with.
So is your approach, Richard, to this whole thing, which is that since it's not going to be obviously adopted on a national level, look, it's incredibly difficult, at least now, that you do it first in New York?
Yeah. You know, an awful lot of our advances in social policy in this country were done in what people have called the laboratories of democracy, namely the states. Wage and hour laws, minimum wage, worker protections, the whole concept of public education. All of these things began at the state level and then spread nationally. That's how the universal health coverage system in Canada began. A couple of provinces did it, and then a couple more, and before you knew it, the whole country was covered. And fortunately, despite the craziness in Washington, there are several states, I think New York is one of them, where politics is an awful lot smarter and more progressive. And I think we can do it. You know, we're having a press conference today with the Working Families Party and the Healthcare Workers Union 1199 and the Communication Workers and the UAW and the pediatricians and the family practice physicians and a lot of other groups, the Nurses Association, all endorsing the bill. I think with people's realization under federal healthcare reform that there is so much more that we can do better, I think we've got a real shot at it in New York.
So who's on board, as we say? You're the department chair, the respected department chair, as we say in the academy, as the chair of the health committee. And that's got to go a long way among your colleagues. It's a fairly progressive house. Mm-hmm. We know the Republicans some of the Republicans plus a group of other sort of Democrats who control the Senate. First of all, have you got your speaker on board?
Well, you know, it's interesting. When we first introduced the bill 20 plus years ago, before Speaker Silver was the speaker, he was one of the original co-sponsors of the bill. As speaker, he doesn't put his name on a lot of bills. I think it would be accurate to say that on the merits, he understands the good sense that the bill makes. I think he's very wary of the fact that it would be portrayed as an enormous increase in taxes. I keep saying to him, well, yeah, but that's after we eliminate premiums and deductibles and copayments and administrative costs and all of the rest. And that the bottom line is that New Yorkers would be paying dramatically less for health coverage. Yes, it would now be shifted to public revenue. But his political advisors keep telling him, you know, bottom line is the T word. So we're working to overcome that politics. The bill is now sponsored by, I think, 72 members of the Assembly, which means it's about three-quarters of the Democratic majority. So I think we have a real shot at getting it to the floor this year and passed in the Assembly. Obviously, on the Senate side, we're going to have to elect several more Democrats for this issue and for a lot of others. And hopefully we will begin to get the attention of the governor on this topic.
Well, let's talk about the Senate for a minute, because I find it absolutely fascinating. You've got more Democrats in the Senate than you have Republicans, but you got these four guys and one other who sits with a Republican. So you have five Democrats sitting over there. And when they announced that they were going to have this power-sharing agreement in the Senate, the Republicans and the Democrats, it was announced at the time each leader, a guy named Klein from the Bronx and Dean Skelos, the Republican leader, would take 2 weeks on and 2 weeks off. It certainly hasn't happened that way, has it?
I don't know whether technically they do the 2 weeks checkerboard thing, but, you know, they seem to run some sort of power-sharing arrangement. I don't quite understand it. Fortunately, I don't have to lobby the Senate for a living.
No, but Dick, I'm thinking about the fact that if there was a fair up or down vote, and if Klein allowed such a bill to come to the floor, which he frequently doesn't, it would probably pass in the Senate.
Well, you know, I don't know. I'm sure there are probably some Senate Democrats that might not vote for it. But I think realistically we're a long way from that happening, certainly in the next year or two until there is some significant electoral change over there.
So then let's talk about the big kahuna, the governor.
Right.
Now, here is a guy who has branded himself as a sort of conservative fellow. As you say, the T word is an anathema, taxes. And, you know, it would take quite a strenuous thing to haul him into this vortex, wouldn't it?
Well, you know, I've said to a couple of people in the administration that, you know, you might say that this is, you know, an enormous stretch politically. You could call it far-fetched. I said, but I don't think this is any more far-fetched than campaign finance reform, which he continues to campaign for. It is probably, you know, single-payer health coverage is certainly less of a threat to the established political order than campaign finance reform.
Well, let me fight with you about that for a minute. Don't you think that the lobbyists, we know there's well-heeled lobbyists around Albany, and you know them because they're always on your doorstep, and the insurance companies are right there, aren't they?
The health insurance industry is certainly a very powerful force politically in Albany. I think, though, ultimately, the more people understand about the limitations of the insurance system and the more they understand how it could be run differently, I think hopefully more of the labor movement, more of healthcare professionals will come on board. I think at that point it becomes an almost unstoppable force.
Yeah, except lobbyists have a lot at their disposal in terms of money, campaign cash, you know, the rest of it, and they can be pretty lethal.
They can, and, you know, I'm not delusional here.
You certainly are anything but that.
Right.
Yeah, okay.
This is, you know, this effort is not for the faint of heart. You know, the first universal health coverage bill in North America was introduced in 1915 by then Assemblyman Al Smith.
Interesting.
So, you know, this is an effort that's been going on for a while.
Harry Truman wanted some, didn't he?
Harry Truman did. Franklin Roosevelt did. But the AMA at that point, you know, got him not to propose it. Nelson Rockefeller was advancing a version at the state level, a version of a universal health plan at one point.
So I hate to do this to you, but you're a Democrat, liberal Democrat, and your president's signature program is what we call the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare. Mm-hmm. This puts you at some odds with your own president, right?
Well, the Affordable Care Act, if I had been in Congress at the time and that was the bill in front of me, I would have voted for it. It's done a lot of very important things for remaking the healthcare system, but unfortunately, it still leaves us in the hands of insurance companies. You know, President Obama said early on, I believe, that if he could do a single-payer system, he believed that's the system that makes the most sense. You know, if I had a dollar for everybody in health policy and public policy who has told me, you know, privately, well, everyone knows single-payer is the only thing that makes sense, you know, I'd be a rich man.
Count me in.
All right.
So the idea here is just to push, keep pushing, and hope that people come to their senses.
Yeah, I think if the people who know that this is the right way to go say it publicly, write letters to their newspapers, get the organizations they belong to pass resolutions, write to their legislators and their governor, I think it begins to happen.
Okay. I just want to, I've got so much I want to talk to you about. So let me just start with this. Medical marijuana, mm-hmm. I know that you've been a supporter. Can you sort of diagram where we are now?
Well, you know, the governor in the State of the State speech announced that he was going to activate a 1980 law that's never really been used that authorizes, on a very limited basis, medical use of marijuana. It's a very clunky law. It makes really no workable provision for producing the product except getting it either from law enforcement or from the, you know, the federal government has a small farm in Mississippi where they raise marijuana for research purposes. It would not give you access to the various specialized strains of marijuana that have been developed in other states like Colorado that are tailored to particular serious conditions. There would be really no production or distribution method put together. I think I'm very excited that the governor has endorsed the concept of medical use and is trying to do something on an interim basis. But what he really needs to do is to say that he will work with the legislature to pass a comprehensive, workable bill. You know, for the last several years, our friends in the state Senate, particularly the Republicans, have said, you know, why should we go out on a limb doing a marijuana bill if the governor isn't going to be there? Well, if the governor says, I'm here, I'm going to work with you on passing a bill, then I think we can get that done this year. And there are, you know, just thousands and thousands of New Yorkers who are suffering with serious, debilitating, and life-threatening conditions whose lives could be made dramatically better and longer if we would join the 20 states and the District of Columbia that have enacted medical marijuana laws.
Okay, moving along rather quickly, I want to just ask you whether you are for the total legalization of marijuana. Forget about medical.
I'm a co-sponsor of Senator Liz Krueger's, what she calls, tax and regulate model. I think that makes sense. I don't think anyone could argue that marijuana is anywhere near as dangerous as alcohol. And I think it just makes sense.
And the first mess that happens on the Taconic State Parkway with somebody who's stoned and going the wrong way, you would say?
I would say there are millions of New Yorkers who use marijuana occasionally or regularly.
True.
And I think we learned in the 1920s that prohibition is not a very effective public policy. The way you discourage people from driving while either drunk or stoned is
sure.
Primarily by education. To some extent, law enforcement aimed at traffic law enforcement. I don't think prohibition has ever been very effective.
Okay, so let's move on to pre-K. I know it's something that you're for. Mm-hmm. Personally, I've certainly never seen any argument against it.
Yeah.
We have a fight going on. You come from New York City. You're probably as liberal as you get in the New York State Legislature.
I plead guilty to that.
Yeah, you know, right. So now we see a debate between de Blasio, obviously, the new mayor, who is wildly for this, wants to have taxes to support it, and the governor, who doesn't want the taxes, and
yeah.
Says, we'll do it and we'll phase it in. Can you help us understand this?
Well, you know, the money for a universal pre-K program is going to come from somewhere, and without new revenue being brought into the picture, the money for pre-K is going to come by taking it away from something else in the school system or something else in the healthcare system, or, you know, not paving state roads as much, or snow removal. It's going to come from somewhere. The Mayor de Blasio has, I think, very sensibly proposed that if New Yorkers who make more than $500,000 a year pay a tax increase that amounts to about a fancy cup of coffee a day, we could pay for universal pre-K and middle school after school programs in New York City, and know for sure that the money will be there as opposed to annual budget fights. I think this is the kind of really important program for building equality of opportunity that it makes sense to fund fairly by looking to New Yorkers who have been fortunate enough to be enormously financially successful.
So we go back to the state Senate again, because it's going to land in their lap.
Yep.
Clearly, this is where the rubber would hit the road. So take out your crystal ball and tell us how it ends.
I'm pretty optimistic that the legislature will ultimately let New York City tax its people. You know, practically every week we pass a bill in the legislature allowing one county or another to raise or continue the higher level of their local sales tax. You know, we do this kind of thing, allowing localities to determine their tax rate. There are a lot of things. Very often legislative leaders in Albany say, you know, we're not doing this, we're not doing that. And ultimately, sometimes it works out that we do. So I'm very hopeful that this will be resolved in a progressive way that will benefit New York school kids and not do it by taking resources away from something else important in the school system.
Just a minute on casinos. Do they affect people's health?
Do they affect people's health?
Yeah. In other words, there's mental health issues. There's alcoholism.
Well, there's the alcoholism, problem gambling, et cetera. I often have to explain to people that there are lots of things in life that are healthy or unhealthy that aren't within the jurisdiction of the health committee. Although
yes, except you are our expert on health.
I mean, my feeling about casinos. I mean, I voted against the constitutional amendment last November. I think right now the most important issue is to let every locality have the land use control power to decide whether they should have a casino in town. You know, or local governments decide whether, you know, to allow a glue factory on Main Street. I think they ought to be entrusted with the power to decide whether there should be a casino in town. Assemblymember Dee Dee Barrett and I have introduced the bill to give that power to localities. Senator Liz Krueger and I think it's C.C. Kasich are carrying it in the state Senate.
Okay, but basically, you're not a huge proponent of casinos or what they bring to communities.
Right.
Okay, let's go on to Pete Seeger.
Yes.
You and I both enjoy Pete. We both grieve his passing, and there's a move afoot. Mm-hmm. And I wonder how you feel about this, to name one of two things after Pete. He was a guy who eschewed, of course, having things named for him or after him while he was alive. But the famous bridge over the Hudson, the walkway over the Hudson is one, which I certainly favor. And then the other is the Tappan Zee Bridge. What do you think?
Yeah. Well, I very strongly support naming the walkway over the Hudson Bridge. I think it's about as fitting a monument to Pete as could be. It's a low-tech, environmentally sound way to enjoy the Hudson River that he loved so much. There are a couple of problems with naming the Tappan Zee Bridge for Pete. Number one, several years ago it was named in honor of Malcolm Wilson, so we'd have to take his name off.
Oh, interesting. I didn't know that. Yeah.
None of us knows that. I mean, I knew it at the time, and when someone mentioned it, I said, oh, gee, right, I remember that.
Yeah.
There is an effort to rename the Tappan Zee the Purple Heart Bridge, so I don't know that we want to get into a fight with veterans.
But I keep hearing that the name Cuomo somehow is figuring in all of this, that there may be a Cuomo name on it.
I don't know. You know, the more substantive problem with the Tappan Zee Bridge is that one of the controversies with it is that it, you know, the governor rejected the idea of a mass transit component on the bridge, and I think that would have been something Pete would have wanted to have. And I gather there are some serious environmental questions arising in the construction of the bridge. And I don't know that Pete would want to be connected with that either. On the plus side, the cables in the bridge design do seem to resemble banjo strings.
That's great.
But I think the walkway over the Hudson would be a terrific thing to name in honor of Pete and Toshi. And I think it would bring attention to the walkway bridge itself.
Sure. No, I think that's great. After all, you know, we name other bridges for people who I have my doubts about. One governor who held up a glass of PCBs and said he would drink a glass of PCBs. And we named
something tunnel
for him. Yeah, tunnel for him. Yeah. Talk to me about electronic cigarettes. Will they kill us? When I say us, I mean as a society.
Well, my concern about electronic cigarettes is primarily that they are a mechanism for people who are addicted to tobacco to sustain their addiction while they are in environments where it's, you know, impolite or not allowed to smoke. And so while for some people they may be a way to kick your addiction to nicotine, for an awful lot of people they are a way to sustain that addiction when you're someplace where you can't smoke tobacco. So if I had a magic wand, I'd get rid of them. Of course, I don't have a magic wand, or at least not one that works. Somebody gave me a souvenir magic wand that they bought at the Broadway show Wicked, but I haven't figured out how to make it do
you've,
magic.
You've tried, though, right?
I have, yeah. Yes. So whether we should be banning them, like in restaurants, I'm kind of torn about that because, you know, we ban cigarettes in restaurants because it harms the health of your neighbor. I'm not convinced that that's true for e-cigarettes, although it may be, depending on what's in the vapor. But if there were a way to wish them away, I would certainly do that because I don't think nicotine addiction is good for people. But remember, earlier in the program, I said I'm not a big fan of prohibition. So I don't know that we should be outlawing them as opposed to hoping they would go away.
A yes and no answer. I'm so sorry, Dick. It's not fair to you, but the State Board of Regents has now given more time for the Common Core to be implemented. Is this good or bad?
I think more time makes sense. Yeah.
That's a good answer. We're out of time, and our guest has been New York State Assemblyman Richard Gottfried. Richard, it was too short. We'll have to have you on a lot more.
Anytime.
And it's great to hear your voice, and we'll see you soon. Thanks so much for joining us.
A pleasure.
The Capital Connection is distributed with the cooperation of the public radio stations of New York State. David Gustina is the producer of The Capital Connection, a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio in Albany. Support for The Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.